The good news is the end is in sight. Two more Sundays after this one, and we will be done with this church discipline study, Lord willing. So I probably won't preach on church discipline for a long time from today, because I assume that everybody's got a pretty good handle on it by now, I hope. Go ahead and turn to Romans 1 and verse 30. We didn't make it through the list there in Romans chapter 1 yet. We left off last time on boasters. So I'll just read verses 29 through 32 to refresh your memories. Romans 1, 29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. So Lord willing, we'll get through this passage today, and we'll also go over to 1 Timothy chapter 6, and we will be able to cover those that list there, and then next time we'll look in 2 Timothy, and then we'll cover some specific instances of things that are merit church discipline that are not in these lists, and then we'll look at how to deal with excluded members, and then we should be done. So we're going to pick up there with inventors of evil things. An inventor is, you'll never guess, one who invents. It is one who finds out, a discoverer, whether by chance or by investigation and effort. Now that's the primary definition. And I'm going to go on to show you a couple of more definitions, which I think bear out what we're talking about here, because these first two are obsolete. But if you think about it, when we think of an inventor, you're going to think about definition number three, and we'll get there in just a second. But an inventor does find things out or discover things. Like, nobody invented electricity, right? We talk about people inventing electricity. Nobody invented electricity. They discovered electricity. And so basically what inventors do is they discover certain things and how certain physical properties work that nobody knew before, and then they can take those things and they can apply them to some practical use. Number two is one who devises or contrives, a contriver, designer. Now usually one who devises something fictitious or false, a fabricator, formerly also founder or institutor. So when you think about in that case, you're talking about somebody who is inventing maybe a lie or a story or something. It's not a physical inventor, but somebody who's coming up with something that is false, like a slanderer. Number three is one who devises or produces something new, as an instrument, an art, etc., by original contrivance, the originator of a previously unknown method or means of doing something, the first finder out. And I didn't even make that up, finder out. I couldn't imagine that's actually a word, but they have it in there. And this says the prevailing sense, and that's why I've included definition number three. And this is generally what we think of when we think of an inventor, somebody who has created something that previously didn't exist. Now, the Bible does use the term inventors, and it's usually almost always speaking of people that are inventing false religious practices or something, not so much inventing physical objects. But I think that the definition includes that, certainly. Idolatry and false religion are evil inventions. So when we see inventors of evil things, somebody that invents a false religion or invents an idol to worship, that is by definition an inventor of an evil thing, because false religions are evil, idolatry is evil. Let's look at Psalm 99 and verse 8. So if any of you go and create your own religion, you know, we're going to exclude you from the church, but you'd probably be gone anyway. But that would be an inventor of an evil thing. People like Joseph Smith or Ellen White that started the Seventh-day Adventist, I think. And people, Charles Taze Russell was a Jehovah's Witness guy. And people like that anyway. L. Ron Hubbard, the Church in Scientology. Constantine, Catholic Church, you know, inventors of evil things. Psalm 99 and verse 8. It says, Thou answerest them, O Lord, our God. Thou wast a God that forgavest them, though thou tookest vengeance on their inventions. He wasn't talking about the wheel or any other of these primitive inventions they had back then. He's talking about their inventions of false religion and idolatry. And I guess those would be physical inventions in a sense, because they would carve the idols out of gold or wood. And so in that sense, I guess they would have created something physical. Look in Psalm 106 in verse 29 and 39. Psalm 106, 29 and 39. Says, Thus they provoked him to anger with their inventions, and the plague brake in upon them. And then we read that Phinehas there executed judgment, Shishkabobbed a couple of fornicators. But Israel was going after their idols whenever he says there that they provoked him to anger with their inventions. Verse 39 says, Thus were they defiled with their own works and went a-whoring with their own inventions. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance. So the Lord, his attitude has not changed towards inventors of evil things. It was an excludable offense in the Old Testament, and it's still an excludable offense today. Look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 29. Of course, God can never be held accountable for the evil inventions of men, because God made us upright, and then we are the ones that went after these inventions. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 29. It says, Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. Cain was an artificer. Cain was the institutor, and his kin were the institutors of the music and the arts and working in iron and brass and all those types of things. So Cain was an inventor. It started out early. And mankind from pretty much the dawn of time has invented to them gods and invented to themselves religions. And this is not God's fault. He made us upright, but it's man's fault. Man has a deep inclination and drive to worship something. And once a man has a fallen nature, then man is going to naturally not seek the true God, but he's going to seek something as a replacement for it. And that's where all these false religions come from. I guess I don't have enough, well, for one thing, I know the truth, but for two, I don't have enough confidence in myself to try to start a false religion. I just would think that nobody would ever buy it. But some of these guys have really grandiose plans, and it works, I guess, because they have the devil behind them. But you think about some of the crazy religions that people come up with, like Joseph Smith, and you read it, and it just sounds like a fairy tale. It sounds like just silliness, right? But millions and millions of people follow him. So it's, I don't know. I'd say it has to be satanic, personally. I can't imagine somebody could just come up with that on their own and be successful at it. Let me give you some examples of evil inventions. These would be more of the natural type inventions. Like, for instance, devices that were made with the intent to harm or to murder somebody with. That would be an evil invention, or something that's made to torture somebody with. So back in the Dark Ages, when the Catholic Church was murdering and torturing people, if you were somebody that invented some of these horrible devices to do something like that, that's an inventor of an evil thing. Or, and this is a gray area, because you could say that somebody that invents a gun, or you know, that if you invented it with the purpose of murdering somebody with it, you could be an inventor of an evil thing. But a gun in and of itself is not evil. And I think about, like, you know, people that work for the military-industrial complex. It's a gray area. I mean, if you're developing a weapon that the purpose of it is to mass murder tons of people, and it's a war of aggression, and you're making it for that purpose, that would be an inventor of an evil thing. Now, if you're making it for the purpose of self-defense, in your mind you're saying, hey, these bombs are going to protect our country, and I'm not making them so that we can go over there and mass murder people, then it wouldn't be an evil thing. It would be something of self-defense. And I guess I would leave that up to every man's whatever you're comfortable with in your conscience. But I guess for my own self, I would think, have we had a war of self-defense in, oh, I don't know, let's just say the last 200 years? I would say no. World War II would be maybe the only exception to that. And we pretty much provoked Japan to attack us, knew they were going to attack us, and allowed them to attack us, and Germany never attacked us. So I don't even say that was a war of self-defense. So basically, when you have a country that for the last 200 years of its history has had wars of aggression against foreign nations who have done us no harm, and we're developing bombs and white phosphorus and napalm and Agent Orange and all this horrible stuff just to murder people. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable with it myself. But if in your mind you're thinking I'm doing it for self-defense, okay, I guess it could be all right. How about pornography? That's an evil invention. That's an inventor of an evil thing. We know pornography is evil. We talked about that before. How about spy software? Now, once again, I mean, you could be developing it for, you know, national security reasons or whatever, and that might be okay. But what if you know you're developing spy software that's going to be used to spy on American citizens without a warrant? I would say that's an inventor of an evil thing. And I don't think any justification, if you know what it's going to be used for, there's no justification for something like that, I don't think. Filthy movies or TV shows, that's an inventor of an evil thing. Now, of course, all movies are not filthy. All TV shows are not filthy. A lot of them are, probably the majority of them are these days. But if you make a filthy movie like that, that would be an inventor of an evil thing. I would say a person that works in Hollywood and wanted to come to this church to be a member, if you are working on producing rated R filthy movies, you're going to have to repent of that before you get baptized because you're inventing evil things. Books with evil content. You know, if you're writing books telling somebody how to cheat on their wife or something like that, or writing books telling how to properly torture people or something like that, that's an inventor of an evil thing. How about laws that punish righteousness or pardon wickedness? That's an evil thing. That is an inventor of an evil thing. Most of our congressmen are inventors of evil things because most of the laws that they pass are not just and good laws. The Supreme Court, the decisions they hand down, those are evil things. They are inventors of evil things. When you pass down a decision which says that you can murder the unborn or that two sodomites have every right to get married or whatever and receive all the benefits of marriage, that's an inventor of an evil thing. Or websites that are made for the purpose of enabling sin. Like, for instance, if I found out that one of you was the owner of the website Ashley Madison, we're going to put you out of the church. I hope you don't even know what Ashley Madison is. It's a website that people use to go to cheat on their spouse. It's like a dating site for people that are already married. It's horrible. It's disgusting. And thankfully, some people have hacked into that site, and that's why I know about it. I've heard about it in the news. People have hacked into it and then released their lists of people that are members of the site. Pigs, they deserve it. And of course, I'm sure that's wrecked a lot of marriages, but that didn't wreck any marriages. It was the pigs that were on the site that wrecked the marriage. Somebody just exposed them. Their sin found them out. So those kind of things, and there's probably numerous others, but those are just some examples of evil inventions that would be prohibited by this verse and would be met with church discipline. So if it is commonly known that a church member has invented an evil thing, whatever that might be, whether it's some intellectual thing or some physical thing, that would be that person would be put out of the church. Back in Romans 1:30, the next one is disobedient to parents. This is one to think about, especially for children, young children that are still in their parents' house that are baptized. Disobedient is withholding obedience, refusing or failing to obey, neglectful or not observant of authoritative command, guilty of breach of prescribed duty, refractory, rebellious. Children are supposed to obey their parents. We read in Ephesians chapter 6. 1 through 3. The children, it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. Likewise, in Colossians 3 and verse 20, children are told 2, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Now, of course, there comes a point in every child's development when he gets to be old enough that he should be on his own and has a right to be on his own. And at that point, he has a right to leave home. And if your parents would forbid you to do that or something, you know, at some point, they are, your parents are usurping authority that doesn't belong to them anymore. And what exactly that age is, I'm not going to get into right now. I don't know. I mean, I think it would depend on each child. But at some point, a child has a right. He's not a child anymore. He's an adult, and he has a right to be on his own. But while you are under your parents' roof, I don't care if you're 50 years old, whatever your parents say goes. Right? If you don't like it, move out. But that's, you got to obey your parents until you're out from underneath their roof. Now, being a rebellious child was an excludable offense in the Old Testament as well. Only it was a permanent exclusion, and there was no restoration. It was stoning, death. Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 through 21. Now, it's a wise parent that gives their child as much leeway and as much freedom as he possibly can. I think parents that hold their kids with too tight of a leash, especially when they start to get older, are foolish. And I've seen, I'm sure we've all seen, kids that go hog wild, or they just rebel and leave or something because their parents were too harsh on them. So, you know, you want to be careful with that, and I'll hopefully figure that out someday. And I'm thinking about those things right now. I think it's good to think things through before you get to that situation. My wife and I have been talking about that, and this is years down the road for us, but by the time we had kids old enough for that, but I still think about that. What's the proper, how much restraint do you want to have? And I don't know. I think personally I'd rather err on the side of caution when they're young, and then, you know, I'd rather take a chance of sheltering them a little too much when they're young than losing them and regretting it later. But that's kind of my personal take on it. Deuteronomy 21, 18 through 21. It says, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him will not hearken unto them. You see, the parents did what they were supposed to. They chastened him. This wasn't a matter of parents that weren't disciplining their children. This is a case of parents that were disciplining their children, and he was still stubborn and rebellious. Sometimes you have that. That does happen. The general rule is it doesn't happen. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22 and verse 6. So the rule is if you do it right, they're not stubborn and rebellious, because you beat that rebellion out of them when they're little. But every once in a while, you do have rebellious kids, even when you're doing it right. Then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him, and bring him out unto the elders of his city, and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of his city, that this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones, that he die. So shalt thou put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. So for Israel, like I said, permanent excludable offense. This boy was stoned. This is obviously an older child if he's a glutton and a drunkard, I would hope. I mean, if it's a six-year-old kid or something, then those parents got some issues. But I would assume he's a teenager or something like that, and still young enough to be under their roof is what I would have to conclude from that text. But you know, parents bear some culpability in this too, though, because you shouldn't let your children be disobedient. It's up to you whether or not they're disobedient or not. I mean, they can be initially disobedient, but whether you put up with it or not is up to you. And you are doing your children a disservice if you allow them to be disobedient. You're the parents. It's up to you to not let them. And I don't know, maybe you think a hard man, I'll put it that way. I was thinking of another three-letter word, but maybe you think I'm a hard guy. But I say, you tell your children once, one time, do this. Go downstairs, clean your room, run the vacuum cleaner, stop playing that game, whatever. one time, and when they don't listen, you spank them. Only one command needs to be given. You don't need to tell them twice or three times or more. If they don't obey, they get a spanking immediately and swiftly. You think I'd be doing nothing but giving my kids spankings all day? That's right, for about a week or maybe a couple days. And after a week, I would bet if you do that, you give them a command, they don't listen, they immediately get a spanking. After a week, I will bet you what's going to happen is you're going to tell them to do something and they're going to say, ah, mom and dad mean what they say and they're going to do exactly what you told them to do. That's what I would bet. I don't have personal experience, though I have been around a while and I have plenty of friends with kids and I have seen this done. So I know it does work. But if you teach your kids that they only have to obey after the third time, how many times are they going to wait to be told something before they obey? Three times, right? If you teach them that they only have to obey whenever I get screamed at, they're only going to obey when they get screamed at. But if you teach them they obey when you say it the first time in a calm voice, they're going to do it after the first time in a calm voice. So you take the advice or not. It'd be make for a more peaceful existence if you do, believe me. So children that are church members living with their parents who are commonly known to be disobedient, rebellious toward their parents, will be put out of the church. So this is a serious thing. Now you boys there, you are good kids. And I've never seen anything that I would have anything to worry about you two with. You're the only ones that are baptized here. I shouldn't call you a boy. You're 18. You're a man. James is still a boy, though he's bigger than most men. You guys, I don't see anything to worry with, which is great. But, you know, keep on doing what you're doing. You're doing a good job. But for children who are baptized and they're disobedient to their parents, that's an excludable offense. I don't meddle in people's business, really. I mean, if I see somebody heading for a brick wall, then I'll say something. But generally, I kind of preach it, and I don't really, every little thing I see in somebody's life that I don't agree with, I don't say much. But if there was a child in this church that was a church member that was disobedient to their parents, I would say something. And I would tell that child, you better obey your parents, or we're going to put you out of the church. Because then I do have authority to step in and say something. And I would. The next one is without understanding. Romans 1 and verse 31. Without understanding. Understanding is power or ability to understand. Intellect, intelligence. It's of an understanding intelligent, capable of judging with knowledge. It's the faculty of comprehending and reasoning, the intellect. And to understand is to comprehend, to apprehend the meaning or import of, to grasp the idea of. So understanding is the faculty of the intellect. Now, as with all of these things, there are gray areas. What if we had a church member that was mildly retarded or even severely retarded, but he knew enough that he knew that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and that Jesus died for his sins, but maybe he doesn't have much understanding at all? Well, obviously, this is not what this passage is prohibiting. We're not talking about a guy like that. But we're talking about people that should have understanding that don't. That's the problem. As with many of these sins, this is a characteristic of the unregenerate, right? The unregenerate don't have understanding in Romans chapter 3 and verse 11. This is why this and many other of these are excludable offenses, because these are things which unsaved people do and act like. And we're not supposed to act like unsaved people. We're supposed to act like saved people. We're supposed to act like we've been changed inwardly by the grace of God. Romans 3 and verse 11 says, there is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. This is, of course, man in his natural state. None of them understand. This is not talking about people who have been saved by the grace of God, because obviously we understand plenty. The psalmist said, I understand more than the ancients, right? Because I keep thy precepts. So we're not talking about the godly. We're talking about the unregenerate here. The Bible tells us that foolish men are without understanding. Jeremiah 5 and verse 21. Jeremiah 5 and verse 21. Jeremiah 5 and verse 21. Hear this, O foolish people, and without understanding, which have eyes and see not, which have ears and hear not. You see, the foolish people are without understanding. That's why they're foolish. If they had understanding, they wouldn't act like fools. Now, let me give you a bit of a caveat, a bit of a disclaimer. There are certain things in the Scriptures which are hard to be understood. Let me give you a proof text for that. As if you all didn't know that anyway. Does anybody here not know that there are some things in the Scriptures hard to be understood? There's plenty of them. I spend my life looking at Scriptures that are hard to be understood and trying to figure them out. There's lots of them, believe me. Both in the Old and the New Testament. Look at 2 Peter 3 and verse 16. Peter says, and also, in all his epistles, talking about Paul, speaking in them of these things in which are some things hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable rest, as they do also the other scriptures, unto their own destruction. See, the unlearned and the unstable, the people without understanding, they rest the hard passages, but they don't just rest the hard passages, they rest the easy ones too. They rest them all, he says, as they do with the other scriptures. Now I want you to notice a couple things there from that text. He says, in which are some things, not all things. Some things are hard, not impossible, but hard to be understood. So there are some things in the Bible that are difficult to understand. And we've all come across them. That's why I try to, when I can, I try to dismantle hard texts. I spent, a year and a half on problem texts for Sovereign Grace, looking at difficult verses, trying to make them all reconcile together. Sometimes even the disciples of Christ don't understand everything. So take heart. When you don't understand something, just know that the very 12 men that Jesus Christ called out to walk among him, whom he personally taught, did not understand plenty of things. Look in Matthew 5, 15 through 16. And, you know, I wouldn't even say that they didn't understand the hard things. They didn't understand easy things. Like when Jesus says that the Son of Man is going to be crucified by the Gentiles and 3 days later raised from the dead, and they didn't understand. It probably wasn't a matter of that they couldn't understand the words coming out of his mouth. They probably just didn't believe it because, wait a minute, you're the Messiah. How are you going to be crucified and raised from the dead? What does this all mean? So it was one of those things where it's not really hard to understand. It's just hard to accept. That was probably their issue because they had some preconceived ideas about what the Messiah was going to be. He was going to be a king in Israel and reigning like Solomon and those kind of things. What do you mean you're going to be crucified by Gentiles? That doesn't make any sense. Matthew 15, 15 through 16. Peter even went so far as to say, far be it from thee, O Lord. It shall not be. Remember that? And right after Peter said that he was the Son of God, he was the Christ, the Son of the living God, Jesus called him Satan. Matthew 15, 15 through 16. Then answered Peter, and said unto him, declare unto us this parable. And Jesus said, are ye also yet without understanding? They still didn't get it. And this happened on several occasions. They didn't get the parables. But you know, I remember reading, whenever I first started reading through the New Testament, and I would read through the parables, and then try to figure out, as I was reading, to try to figure out what he's teaching. And I didn't even know enough to realize that he's going to explain it, you know, in 10 verses from now. And I would try to figure it out. So I get it. I understand what they're saying, declaring to us the parable, because some of them are not quite so easy to understand. They're easier to understand after you get the interpretation of it, when Jesus tells you what it means, or when a preacher gets up there and expounds it, you know, who understands it better. But when you're first reading it, you're first hearing it, not the easiest thing to understand. It's just the opposite of what people tell us. People tell us that Jesus taught in parables to make it easy for everybody to understand. And yet Jesus says that he taught in parables so that he would make it so people would not understand and perceive and see with their eyes and hear with their ears and be converted with their hearts. He did it to hide the truth from people, not to reveal it in such an easy and simple manner. So if you ever read one of the parables and scratch your head, well, don't feel so bad, because the disciples scratched their head too. So being without understanding of the difficult portion of Scripture is therefore not an excludable offense. Because an apostle himself tells us that some things that his brother in the ministry, Paul, wrote were hard to be understood. And if an apostle says it's hard to be understood, well, that means that, you know, you can be without understanding on difficult portions of Scripture. The path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more into the perfect day. We're all continually learning. That's the whole point. That's why we come to church. That's why we read our Bibles privately. But if you're without understanding, where you just don't understand any spiritual thing, and it's demonstrably so, where you don't have the foggiest idea about anything, things that you clearly should know, very basic principles of the gospel, then that's a problem. And if that's the case, if a man shows that he has no understanding of spiritual things, he'll be put out of the church. The next one there in Romans chapter 1 and verse 31 is covenant breakers. So in order to know what a covenant breaker is, we have to know what a covenant is. And when we figure that out, pretty easy to figure out what a covenant breaker is. A covenant is a mutual agreement between two or more persons to do or refrain from doing certain acts, a compact, contract, bargain, sometimes the undertaking, pledge, or promise of one of the parties. So whenever you have an agreement with somebody, especially a written agreement, but even a verbal agreement, if you give somebody your word, I will do this or I will not do this, that's a covenant. And if you break that covenant, that's a serious thing. You don't break your word. When you tell somebody, I will do something, and I don't mean like, hey, I'll call you tomorrow and you forget or something, but I mean when you make a contract with somebody and you say, I will do this, and this is a promise and a guarantee, that's an excludable offense to break such a thing. Now, adultery is covenant breaking. That's one example. Job said in Job 31 and verse 1 that he had made a covenant with his eyes to not think upon another woman. Job 31 and verse 1. Job 31 and verse 1. I made a covenant with mine eyes, Job said. Why then should I think upon a maid? You see, the marriage covenant is sexual in nature. You make a covenant where you promise to be sexually faithful to that spouse, and you would not look at another as the object of your love. This is what Job is saying. He made a covenant with his eyes. He promised himself that he would never look at another woman. Look at Malachi 2 and verse 14. Malachi 2 and verse 14. The Lord says, yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, yet is she thy companion, the wife of thy covenant. You see, marriage is a covenant. That's why the Lord says she's the wife of thy covenant. And if you commit adultery and you break that covenant, then you are a covenant breaker. Now, divorce is not covenant breaking as long as the man who files for divorce remains sexually faithful to his wife and doesn't have any other kind of a sexual relationship with anybody. So if a man and wife divorce, if they split up and they remain sexually faithful to each other, they have not broken the covenant, because the covenant was to not look upon another. The covenant is to not look at the object, look at somebody else as the object of your love. So in that case, you can be divorced and not be guilty of covenant breaking. But if you remarry, or if you get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, then you're guilty of covenant breaking and adultery, for that matter. Because even though you have divorced, you're still bound in covenant by God to that woman or to that man. You're bound as long as you live. Romans 7 says that the woman is bound by the law of her husband as long as he liveth. So if a man breaks a covenant or a contract or a promise made to another person, he is guilty of covenant breaking. And if it's commonly known, he will be put out of the church. Now, if you have written into the covenant certain allowances for dissolving the covenant, that's okay. Let's say you contract to buy a house or something, and you put down $1,000 earnest money or something like that, and then you decide later, you know, that's a bad idea, I don't want to do that. And I'm not talking about myself, by the way, just in case you're wondering. But you think that's a bad idea, I'm not going to do that, and you decide to not follow through with the purchase, and the company keeps your $1,000. You're not a covenant breaker, because the covenant said that you're going to buy this house, and basically if you don't, you forfeit the $1,000. So that's all part of the covenant. Now, if you broke, you didn't really break the covenant, but if you failed to purchase the house and then you somehow got the, to try to keep the money or something, then you're a covenant breaker. You have not kept the terms of the contract. Okay, without natural affection is the next one. Affection is, when we're speaking of the mind, this is the second Roman numeral, the second primary definition. It is an affecting or moving of the mind in any way, a mental state brought about by any influence, an emotion, or feeling. Now, so that's what an affection is. Natural is implanted, existing, or present by nature, inherent in the very constitution of a person or thing, innate, not acquired, or assumed. So therefore, a natural affection would be a state of mind that all men have by nature. It would be certain feelings that we have as human beings towards other human beings or towards things. Those emotions and those feelings which are natural, which are part of our very being, that is natural affection. Let me give you some examples of natural affection. And this would go for the regenerate or the unregenerate, because these are natural things. These are inborn into us. Caring for one's children would be the first example. Look at Matthew chapter 7, 9 through 11. This is a natural affection. Most people, even if they are wicked people, evil people, members of false religions, or just nasty people to most of their neighbors, even most of those people are decent to their own kids. Right? I don't know, did Hitler have kids? I don't know if he had kids. But Stalin, Mussolini, Lenin, I don't know, any of those guys, Pol Pot, Mao, did they have kids? Some of them must have had kids. Nero, did he have kids? Probably. I mean, I'm sure most of these people did. And I would be willing to bet, and I don't know, I haven't researched all those people, but I would be willing to bet that most of those guys were probably pretty nice to their own kids. That's a natural thing. So you can't look at some dictator that's mass murdered millions of people and say, but he was a good father. Well, so what? I mean, that doesn't take grace. That doesn't take anything. Be nice to your own kids. Now, some people aren't nice to their own kids. What does that tell us about them? They are without natural affection. That's just not normal. You should be nice to your own kids. Matthew 7, 9 through 11. Or what man is there of you whom, if his son ask bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he give him a serpent? If ye then being evil, see, we're not talking even here about the regenerate necessarily. If ye then being evil know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good gifts unto them that ask him? So actually he is talking to the regenerate. He says your Father in heaven, and yet they still have an evil human nature to them. If ye then having an evil human nature still know enough to give your kids bread instead of a stone or a fish instead of a scorpion, if you know that much, well, then how much more so is your Father in heaven going to give you good gifts? He's reasoning from the lesser to the greater. If you, being the evil slime ball that you are, know how to give good gifts to your kids, your Father in heaven is going to do much better than that. But the purpose of the text was, what I'm using it for, is that even sinners know enough to give their kids good gifts, to give them food that would nourish them. They wouldn't tie them up and beat them and do horrible things to them or something. That is totally unnatural. Look at Lamentations 4 and verse 10. And people that would do that deserve to be put to death. Not only in the church, they need to be put to death by the firing squad. Lamentations 4 and verse 11. 4 and verse 10, pardon me. Lamentations 4:10. The hands of the pitiful woman have sodden their own children. They were their meat in the destruction of the daughter of my people. You know what that's talking about? You know what it is to sodden? It's to cook. They cooked their own children and ate them. That's how bad it was in the destruction of Jerusalem of the Babylonians. They ate their own children. Moses prophesied that this would happen. That was one of the judgments that God said would happen. If they turned their backs on him, that would be one of the things that they would eat their own children in the siege. And the same thing happened in 70 AD when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem also. That's without natural affection. I mean, I don't care how hungry most people are. Most people, even if you were dying of starvation, you would not eat your own children. And if you got food, you'd give it to your children first. You would starve before letting them starve. That's natural affection. And every unregenerate sinner, or most unregenerate sinners, would even do that. But these people were so far gone that they resulted to horrible things like that. Having compassion on others is another natural affection. Look at Matthew 12, 1 through 7. Because most people generally have compassion towards other human beings. I mean, there are people out there without natural affection, but in general, even wicked people, atheists, will have, I mean, if they saw somebody that was hurting and suffering, they would try to help that person. Why? Because we're all human beings. We're all people. And we know what it feels like to suffer, and we don't like to see other people suffer. And to do otherwise is really to go against even natural human affection that should be part of who we are, regardless if we have a new nature within us or not. Matthew 12, 1 through 7. It says, at that time Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were an hungered, and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. These Pharisees did not even have natural affection. These men were hungry, and they were going to try to hold up the Sabbath law to keep a person from eating when he is hungry and faint. But he said unto them, Have you not read what David did when he was an hungered, and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? Jesus wasn't condemning David for doing this. Jesus was justifying David and the priests for doing this. Because this is the natural thing to do, to feed a person when they're hungry. And this law of preservation of human life even surpasses the Sabbath law. This is what Jesus is teaching here. It surpassed the law of the showbread. God's laws are set up in a hierarchy. Or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? See, the priests still do work on the Sabbath days. There's a morning and evening sacrifice. They're actually technically profaning the Sabbath, and yet they're blameless. But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. You see, it's natural to have mercy on people. This is what Jesus is saying here. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Look at Matthew 15 and verse 32. Matthew 15 and verse 32. And Jesus called his disciples unto him, and said, I have compassion on the multitude, because they continue with me now 3 days, and have nothing to eat. And I will not send them away fasting, lest they faint in the way. This is a natural feeling towards other human beings. Were all these people regenerate people that were following Jesus Christ? I'm sure they weren't, because most of them left whenever he started preaching hard doctrine. But yet he had compassion on them, because that is the human thing to do. Look at Luke 10, 33 through 34. Luke 10, 33 through 34. This is the story of the Good Samaritan. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him. We remember the man was taken among thieves and left there half dead. And the priest comes by and walks on the other side. The Levite comes by and walks on the other side. And then this stranger, this Samaritan, which was despised of the Jews, sees the man and has compassion on him. And went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the morrow when he departed, he took out 2 pence and gave them to the host and said unto him, Take care of him. And whatsoever thou spendest more, when I come again, I will repay thee. This is the so-called Good Samaritan. This is what natural affection is. When you see somebody that's hurting, you help them. And you know, the sad thing is, I think, is that we are losing natural affection in this society that we live in. We're losing human connection because we have these screens, these phones, and we largely interact with people on the screen. We lose the human element of interaction with other people. And it bothers me, and it bothers me whenever I do it too. Whenever we drive down the road, 30 years ago, when you drove down the road and somebody was broke down there, especially if they're out waving you down for help, people would stop and help, right? Because that's natural affection. But nowadays, what do? We drive by the guy, and what do we say? Ah, he's got a cell phone. He'll be okay. And I've done it too, and I hate it. I hate it when I do that. That's wrong. Especially if if you see the guy out there waving for help, for goodness sake, stop. If you're a man, if you're a woman and you're afraid, I get it. I understand. That's prudent. But if you're a man, for goodness sake, stop. If somebody's out there needing your help. Another natural affection is attraction for the opposite sex. Look at Romans 1, 26 through 27. Romans 1, 26 through 27. But I think we're just losing what it is to be human. And then with this whole transhumanism movement, and they want to implant things in people's brains and give them this omniscience, and we're physically not going to be human in the future, it seems, and we're already emotionally not human now. It's just weird. We don't act like people used to act. Romans 1, 26 through 27. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections. Remember, we're talking about natural affections. Well, here's a vile affection. For even their women did change the natural use. So we're talking about natural affection here. They did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another. Men with men working that which is unseemly and receiving themselves that recompense of their error, which was meet. To have an attraction for the opposite sex is a natural affection. To have an attraction for the same sex, a sexual attraction, is an unnatural affection. A person that does so is without natural affection. Now, the Scripture teaches us some things that we should have affection for, like the house of God, the people of God, heavenly things. I'll just give you some verses for that. 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 3. Here's some things that we ought to set our affections on. These three are very important. 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 3. Moreover, because I have set my affection to the house of my God, I have of mine own proper good of gold and silver, which I have given to the house of my God over and above all that I have prepared for the holy house. This is David speaking. David purposed in his heart to give to the house of God. He actually gave more. He gave over and above because his affection was set on the house of his God. That's a natural affection for a regenerate man anyway. We ought to have our affection set towards the house of God. We ought to love this place. We ought to have a warm feeling and emotion for the house of God, for the people of God. The people of God are the next thing in 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 15. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 15. Paul here is talking about Titus. And he says, his inward affection is more abundant toward you, whilst he remembereth the obedience of you all, how with fear and trembling you received him. Titus had an affection for the people of God. He loved the people of God. And we ought to set our affection on heavenly things. Look at Colossians 3 and verse 2. A lot of our problems would disappear if we had our affections set on heavenly things instead of on earthly things. Say the earthly things pass anyway. And as Paul said, we came into this world with nothing and we shall leave with nothing as well. Colossians 3 and verse 2. So set your affections on things above, not on things of the earth. Paul says in another place in Philippians that our conversation is in heaven. Our manner of life ought to be in heaven. We ought to be concerned about heavenly things. So those that have not feelings of compassion toward their children and their fellow men, or have an attraction to the opposite sex, are by biblical definition without natural affection. And those who are commonly known to be so will be put out of the church. If we see people that just hate their own kids in the church, that's wrong. We're not going to put up with that. If somebody has a sexual attraction to another person of the same sex and it's unrepented of, that's an excludable offense. And if we see people that just don't care about their fellow man and would trample all over them and use and abuse them, that's without natural affection. That would be an excludable offense. The next one is implacable, Romans 1:31. Implacable is that cannot be appeased, irreconcilable, inexorable, it's a person's feelings, etc. Inexorable, which you probably don't know what means, and I didn't know what means either, what it meant, so I am defining it for you, is incapable of being persuaded or moved by entreaty, that cannot be prevailed upon to yield to request, especially in the way of mercy or indulgence, not to be moved for one's purpose or determination, relentless, rigidly severe. Now, it just depends, once again. To be implacable or to be inexorable when it comes to holding fast to the truth and to the faith, it's okay to be inexorable in that way, where it doesn't matter. You are not going to budge. You're going to be unrelentless in your pursuit of the truth and your defense of it. That's okay. But this is not what Paul's talking about here in Romans 1:31. So men who obstinately remain disagreeable after being reasoned with by sound and persuasive arguments are implacable. You ever meet somebody like that? It doesn't matter how you can lay it out ever so clearly, and they're just not going to hear it. They don't want to believe it no matter what. I should send you a video that a friend of mine sent me. It was on Facebook, and then I found it on YouTube. And it was something about, you know, this is how you know when you've lost the argument or something. And my friend sends it to me, a friend of mine from Cincinnati. And he's like, yeah, I've had arguments like this before with contending for the truth or whatever. And it's this guy, I think he's a Spanish guy or something. I think he was speaking in Spanish. And he's arguing with called a spitting goat or something like that. Here's this goat with these big old horns. And you can't understand what he's saying. At least I can't. He's in another language. But he's going on, he's arguing with this goat, and the goat keeps, you know, like spitting at him or whatever. And he comes back, he's telling him, and the goat keeps spitting at him. And then the goat starts this really loud, annoying, like, bah! And literally the goat's tongue is hanging out. He's like, bah! And the guy keeps arguing with him. It's going back and forth, and he's spitting at him and screaming at him. And I thought, yeah, that's about right. I've had that experience plenty of times with people. But it's hilarious. I mean, my face hurt. I was laughing so hard watching this thing. It was absolutely hysterical. Why do you think they call people who aren't children of God goats? Because they act like that goat. Those who can never be appeased, no matter how many concessions are granted to them, are implacable. You ever meet people like that where you're just trying, you just want to get along with them, and you grant them so much, and you'll bend over backwards to try to make them happy, and they just cannot be happy. It's never enough for these people. They're implacable. Let me give you an example. I just thought of this one this morning. Matthew 11, verses 16 through 19. That's why it just doesn't even, once you figure out that you have met an implacable person, you just may as well stop wasting your time, because they're not going to be prevailed against. It doesn't matter how nice you are to them. It doesn't matter how much you offer them. They're always going to want more. It will never be enough. Matthew 11, 16 through 19 says, "But whereunto shall I liken this generation? It is like unto children sitting in the markets, and calling unto their fellows, and saying, We have piped unto you, and ye have not danced. We have mourned unto you, and ye have not lamented. Well, we tried making you happy. We piped unto you, played you some music. You wouldn't dance. Okay, well, try mourning to you. Maybe we'll start crying. Maybe try to appeal to your emotional side. Ye have not lamented. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he hath a devil." See, John was trying to be ultra conservative. "I'm not going to eat any unclean food around these people. I'm not going to drink any alcohol because it might offend them." And what do they say about John? "He hath a devil. Look at him. He thinks he's so self-righteous. Look at him. Possessed of the devil. Won't even have a drink of alcohol." Okay, so Jesus says, "All right, well, okay. Didn't work for John to be abstinent entirely, so I'm just going to eat and I'm going to drink. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, Behold, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners." You can't win with some people. You don't drink, you got a devil. You do drink, you're a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. You know what you do when you met somebody like that? Do whatever the heck you want to do. You can't make them happy anyway. They are implacable. And those who are commonly known to be implacable will be put out of the church. It's just a horrible thing to try to get along with somebody who's just disagreeable. They just don't want to get along no matter what, you know? The next one is unmerciful. Unmerciful is merciless. When you're speaking of persons, it's having or exhibiting no mercy. Now, mercy is forbearance and compassion shown by one person to another who is in his power and who has no claim to receive kindness. Kind and compassionate treatment in a case where severity is merited or expected. You see, we're supposed to be merciful, even when people don't deserve it. And that's kind of redundant to say, be merciful even when they don't deserve it. That's the whole point of mercy. They don't deserve it. But we still ought to be kind and compassionate towards people when they don't deserve it. Because God was kind and compassionate to us when we didn't deserve it. And Jesus taught this by way of a parable, which we'll get to in just a second. But let me just give you a couple of verses that tells us that we're supposed to be merciful. Matthew 5 and verse 7. Matthew 5 and verse 7. "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." If you want to obtain mercy, you must be merciful. Because God is up there and He rights the wrongs. God sees you treat somebody in an unkind or unmerciful way, and He says, "Okay, I'm going to treat you in an unkind, in an unmerciful way." And this is what James says. James said in James 2:13 that he shall have judgment without mercy, who hath showed no mercy. And mercy rejoiceth against judgment, James tells us. You want to have judgment without mercy? Just show somebody no mercy, and God will give you the judgment you deserve. And the Lord said back there in 2 Samuel, in verse 22, that the Lord would be merciful to the merciful, and He would be unmerciful to the unmerciful. 2 Samuel 22, verses 26 and 27. It says, "With the merciful thou wilt show thyself merciful, and with the upright thou wilt show thyself upright. With the pure thou wilt show thyself pure, and with the froward thou wilt show thyself unsavory." God will respond in kind to how you respond to others. So if you're an unmerciful person, don't be surprised when the church is going to be unmerciful with you. We must forgive when we've offended, else God will not forgive us temporarily. Look at Colossians 3 and verse 13. Colossians 3 and verse 13. It says, forgiving one another and forbearing one another and forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. Remember that when you're feeling unforgiving, that Christ forgave you. Forgiveness is the key to making any relationship work. I'd say if you want your marriage to work, learn two things. Learn to forgive and learn to ask for forgiveness. And if you learn to ask for forgiveness and you're not too proud to do so, and you learn to forgive and to not hold those grudges, you'll have a happy marriage. And if you don't, you're going to have a miserable marriage. Because you're going to mess up, right? Everybody's going to mess up. You're going to irritate your spouse. They're going to irritate you. You're going to do things that are going to hurt them. They're going to do things that are going to hurt you. And if you don't ask for forgiveness and if you don't forgive, you're never going to mend those breaches in the relationship. Those who are commonly known to be unmerciful will be put out of the church. And lastly, in Romans 1, in verse 32, and I'll just read you the verse before I comment on it. Romans 1 and verse 32, it says, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. This verse, honestly, was a little confusing to me, just the way in which it was worded. And then one day the light just came on. Who knowing the judgment of God, so these people that do these things, they know the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death. They know the judgment of God. They know that people that commit these things are worthy of death. And knowing that, not only do they do the same, but they have pleasure in them that do them. They know the judgment of God, and yet they do these things anyway, and they have pleasure in them that do them. Both. They do them themselves, and they also derive joy and delight and gratification out of other people that do them. Pleasure is the condition of conscientiousness or sensation produced by enjoyment or anticipation of what is felt or viewed as good or desirable. It's enjoyment, delight, gratification, the opposite of pain. So not only are those that commit the above sins worthy of death to church fellowship, but also those that have pleasure in such sinners. If you delight and enjoy and receive gratification from sinners doing these things, if you're watching movies, watching sinners doing these wicked things, and you like that, and that provides you entertainment and enjoyment, you're guilty of it just like they are. If you read the books about witchcraft and you like that kind of stuff, you're just as guilty as they are. If you read the romance novel about the guy that's having an affair and you derive pleasure and enjoyment from that, you're just as guilty as he is. Now, if you watch a movie and there's an affair in it, an adulterous affair, and it sickens you, that's a different story. I told you we're watching Downton Abbey. Love that show. And I don't want to give it away, but there was an affair in there and it just sickened me. I thought, I can't believe that guy would do that. And you really liked the guy before that, you know? But it should sicken you. You shouldn't derive enjoyment out of it. And you should never be rooting for the adulterer or rooting for the murderer. You ever do that? You ever watch a movie and you end up rooting for the adulterer because, oh, his wife's such a jerk anyway, you know, and you feel bad for him and you're hoping that he gets together with his whore. And think about that. Everybody's smiling because you know what I'm talking about. I've been there too. And then you got to like, what are you doing? You can't root for the evil guy. So therefore, those who are commonly known to support or get enjoyment out of sodomites or fornicators or haters of God or any of these types of people here will be put out of the church. Granted, that one's a little hard to prove. I mean, it's hard to figure out if you get enjoyment out of it, but your sin will find you out. You'll be eventually found out. I mean, if you like attending gay pride parades and we happen to see you on TV down there cheering as they're walking down the sidewalk, you're out of here. I've told you about this before, I met a Lutheran pastor, I'll put in air quotes, a female, and at a meetup group one time, and somehow the topic of sodomy came up. I don't remember if the waiter was a queer or something, I don't remember, and he was talking about the pride parade, and I kid you not, and she said, yeah, I really wish we could go and show our support, but I have church that day. Unbelievable. Okay, so let's quickly get through this next section here, and we shall be done. I don't want to drag this thing out for three more Sundays. We're only going to drag it out for two more Sundays. 1 Timothy 6, 3 through 5. This won't take too long because we've already covered a bunch of these in these other lists. 1 Timothy 6, 3 through 5. It says, if any man teach otherwise and consent not to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which is according to godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, but doting about questions and strifes of words, whereof cometh envy, strife, railings, evil surmisings, perverse disputings of men of corrupt minds, and destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness, from such withdraw thyself. So we know that this is a list of excludable offenses, because in verse 5 he says, from such withdraw thyself. So in other words, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing. Now this might be a pastor withdrawing from a whole church, if he, because he's talking to Timothy, who's a pastor. And I guess if you had a church full of these types, then withdraw from them. But the church as a whole can withdraw from the person who commits these things too, so it can work either way. The first one was proud, which we covered in Romans 1, 29 through 32. The next one is envy, which we covered in Galatians 5, 19 through 21. Strife, we also covered in Galatians 5. Railing, we covered in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 11. The next one is evil surmising. We will look at this one. Evil surmising. Surmising is the action of the verb surmise, the framing of conjecture, suspicion, especially of evil. To surmise is to suppose, imagine that a thing is so, to expect, to suspect, to form a notion that the thing in question may be so on slight grounds or without proof, to infer conjecturally. You ever watch the shows about court cases and somebody will object and they'll say conjecture, that's conjecture. You're basically just surmising and you really don't have any proof for that. Conjecture is the formation or offering of an opinion on grounds insufficient to furnish proof, the action or habit of guessing or surmising, conclusion as to what is likely or probable, in textual criticism, the proposal of a reading not actually found in the traditional text, formally, sometimes in a bad sense, suspicion, evil surmise. So when you evil surmise, you suspect something of somebody, but you really can't prove it. Either you have very little evidence or you have no evidence and you just suspect it. Well, if that's the case, let me give you some advice. Keep your mouth shut. If you don't have proof, keep your mouth shut. And you know what? Don't even allow your mind to wander in that way, even if you're not telling anybody else, because you can destroy somebody in your own mind with your evil surmisings, thinking that they've done something or guilty of something that they may not be. You ever have that? You ever just suspect that something's wrong, somebody's got these bad motives, and then you find out later that it wasn't what you thought at all? That's happened to me before. You don't want to allow that kind of thing to fester in your mind, though, because charity thinketh no evil. Remember that passage, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5? It's not just what you say, it's even what you think. 1 Corinthians 13. Because thoughts turn into actions, and then actions turn into habits, and then habits turn into a way of life. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. This chapter is talking about charity. And it says, That's verse 11. That's chapter 11. It says, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. So a charitable person, a person which has godly Christian love in their heart, doesn't think evil of somebody else. Now, if somebody's done evil, and you're recognizing the evil they've done, and you're judging them for that evil they've done, that's okay. You're not thinking evil in that case. But if you're just suspecting they've done something, you can't prove it, that's another story. God hates imagining evil against one's neighbor. Look at Zechariah 8 and verse 17. And then evil surmising ends up turning into whispering and backbiting, and then you can end up harming relationships, tearing the church apart. So you want to keep it to yourself and address it with the person to help them out. Zechariah 8 and verse 17. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath. For all these things I hate, saith the Lord. So there you got a verse. God hates evil surmising, imagining evil about your neighbor or your friend or your family member, your church brethren. If you don't have the proof, don't let your mind start wandering and come up with some grandiose idea of what they're probably doing or not doing. A negative opinion should never be shared with somebody without concrete proof. And for that matter, it shouldn't be shared with somebody else with concrete proof. If you have concrete proof, share it with the brother that you got the concrete proof on. Share it with the guy that needs to be corrected. Because even if you have the proof, if you're sharing a negative opinion or a negative sentiment about somebody else, like I said, that's backbiting and whispering, which are also excludable offenses. The person should be addressed personally and privately with the intention of helping him out. Look at Proverbs 25. Proverbs 25 and verse 9 says, debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another. If there's one verse that you could memorize to limit the amount of problems that a church would have, I think it's probably this one. Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another. If you've got a problem with somebody, talk to them about it privately. Don't talk to other people about it. And if you do so, you can save a soul from death and hide a multitude of sins. Look at James 5, verses 19 through 20. James 5, 19 through 20. And this is not just for church. This is in every area of life. I remember at the company that I used to work for, this woman got promoted to be a team lead or a project manager or something. And we're having a meeting, and she starts talking about what her surmisings were about another project leader or something, and how, you know, somebody had quit the company. And well, you know, they probably quit the company because of this, the manager or whatever. And I thought, how stupid can you possibly be? Because that's obviously going to get back to that guy that you said that. So and I didn't really care for the guy myself either, but still, you're running that guy down. You don't even know if it's true, and he's the kind of guy that's not going to make your life happy if he finds out about that you were running his name down anyway. I mean, the whole thing was just stupid. You got a problem with him, go talk to him to his face. James 5, 19 through 20. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. See, when you take it up with the brother himself, you save the brother. When you talk to other people about it, you not only destroy your relationship with that brother, you may destroy his reputation, you may bring other people into it, you may sow discord and dissension and debate in the church. All kinds of bad things happen whenever you talk to other people about it. But when you talk to the brother himself, you correct the problem and it's done. It's taken care of. Now, if the person won't receive the correction, then you can bring it before witnesses, and then finally you can bring it before the church. We'll talk about that when we get to Matthew 18, 15 through 17, probably in a week or two. Church members must not tolerate a brother sharing his suspicions about another brother with them. You see, it takes two to tango, so you can't really evil surmise and tell somebody else about it unless that other person will listen. So if somebody is evil surmising about somebody and they try to talk to you about it, don't listen. Tell them that you talk to that person about it. You take it up with them. You don't tell me about it. An angry look will drive away a backbiting tongue, we're told in Proverbs 25 and verse 23. Now those who are commonly known to be evil surmising will be put out of the church. We got two more. Perverse disputings in 1 Timothy 6:5. To dispute is to contend with opposing arguments or assertions, to debate or discourse argumentatively, to discuss, argue, hold disputation, often to debate in a vehement manner or with altercation about something. Now that, and we talked about this debate and that, similar things in the last few weeks, and that in and of itself, it depends on what you're disputing about and who you're disputing with, that might be okay. But we're talking about perverse disputings, whenever you're disputing against the truth, or you're disputing about something that doesn't matter, something like that. That's a perverse disputing. And we basically covered that when we looked at variance and strife in Galatians 5, 19 and 20, and debate in Romans 1, 29 through 32. And lastly, supposing that gain is godliness in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 5. You see, we should know, that gain doesn't necessarily equate to godliness because there are many rich men who are ungodly. There are plenty of people that have got a lot of gain that are certainly not godly, probably the majority of them for that matter. I'm not against rich people, but they're not exactly, you know, the most righteous lot, generally speaking. James 5, 1 through 5. Let me just give you a text of scripture here that tells us that rich men are not always godly. This kind of pokes a few holes in the prosperity gospel. Go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you. And ye shall eat your flesh as it were fire, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped up ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. The cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and have been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter. Clearly rich men, but they're not godly rich men. So gain does not equal godliness. And furthermore, the poor can be godly. So you have rich men that are not godly, and you have poor men that are godly. So there's a double whammy. We know for sure that gain does not equal godliness. James 5 and verse, or 2 and verse 5. James 2, 5. James says, "Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he hath promise to them that love him?" God's chosen the poor, rich in faith. These poor people are godly. So anybody that supposes and teaches that gain is godliness, Paul says you're supposed to withdraw from somebody like that. Imagine what that would do to a church if you had a gospel that taught that if you're godly, you will be wealthy. And here's poor people in the church that aren't wealthy, and what are they going to think? I must have done something wrong. I'm not godly. Well, apparently Jesus did something wrong too, because the Son of Man hath not where to lie his head. He said he certainly was not a rich man in this world. So those that are commonly known to promote this idea that gain is godliness will have to be put out of the church. And next time we will pick up with 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, and then we'll cover the other things that I talked about at the beginning of the service in the week after that, and we'll finally be done. So thank you for your kind and patient attention today.